KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Welcome to Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. For the first time, tribes in the Pacific Northwest won't have to compete with commercial interests when foraging on off-reservation federal lands. The change in direction comes after decades of work by the Yakima Nation and others. And the Ute Mountain Ute Tribe is working with a conservation nonprofit to access traditional plants for food and medicine on surrounding private land. Stay tuned as we talk about these land access developments coming up.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Six tribes have formed a coalition to protect Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument in southern Utah. As David Condos reports for the Mountain West News Bureau, the group's working to conserve tribal homelands.
President Donald Trump shrunk both Grand Staircase Escalante and nearby Bears Ears National Monument in 2017 during his first term. And some people worry history could repeat itself. Hank Stevens is a member of the Intertribal Coalition and part of Utah's Navajo Nation.
With our new administration coming in, you know, there's concerns that we're probably going to have two monuments being shrunk again.
The administration issued an order last month to review national monuments as part of a push to expand gas production and mining on federal lands. Still, Stevens is optimistic the federal government will collaborate with the coalition and make sure Native voices are heard. I'm David Condos.
When you've served 17 years in tribal government, what's the next step? Well, if you're Jason Harris, you start a food truck. Brian Bull talked to the former Catawba assistant chief, whose business, Bow and Arrow, roams South Carolina.
Harris and his wife, Melissa, have both worked in tribal government and still consider themselves ambassadors of a sort, only instead of discussing policy over the table, they share Catawba history and culture over the counter.
One of the things that we have not been good at, especially as Catawbas, we don't share our culture as well as we probably should. So that's kind of given us an opportunity to answer people's questions. You know, not only the food, that's just a starting point, but we can actually get into other conversations. It helps bring our communities together even more.
Many visitors to the Bow and Arrow are non-natives, so Harris feels this is a great way to connect with others. The menu has fry bread as the basis for its entrees.
We have the Bow, which is a ground beef-based Indian taco with the trimmings that go with that. And then we have the Arrow, which is chicken on fry bread. Then we have a bison Indian taco. We hadn't seen a whole lot of that out there in Indian country. And then we do a strawberry dish that is my wife's grandmother's recipe, and it is just out of this world.
The Catawba are South Carolina's only federally recognized tribe, so Harris says it's great to represent his culture and share his passion for good food at the same time.
We get to feed people. Everybody's got to eat. And then we get to share a little bit of our culture, too. So it's been really nice to do that.
The Harris's black and turquoise truck roams the areas on and near the Catawba Reservation, sharing Native cuisine to powwow crowds and passersby alike. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
It's all aboard the victory train for Indigenous language activists in Ireland. Joe McPullen reports on signs of hope at the island's largest integrated transportation hub.
Chucky Ola, get the Brits out, lad, a one-way ticket, please, I've lost my bus pass.
It's been a good year for Ireland's indigenous language. The Irish hip-hop band Kneecap is showcasing the 2,500-year-old language at high-profile festivals this year like Coachella and Glastonbury. And this week in Kneecap's hometown of Belfast, officials in charge of the new Grand Central Station announced plans to install signage with Irish in addition to the King's English. Irish language equality has become a political tool in the historically violent showdown between those who favor a united Ireland and those who wish to keep Northern Ireland as part of the United Kingdom. That's why a handful of far-right politicians are trying to suppress the new signs. More than 2 million people on the island, or 30% of the population, say they have some ability to speak Irish. For National Native News, I'm Sean McPolin in Ireland.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Enbridge strives to be a good steward of the environment, a safe operator of essential energy infrastructure, and a good neighbor. More on Enbridge's Indigenous Reconciliation Action Plan at Enbridge.com. Enbridge proudly supports this program.
Support by Sanofsky Chambers Law, championing tribal sovereignty and Native American rights since 1976, from opioids litigation to treaty rights to tribal self-governance, with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska. Sanofsky Chambers Law.
Support provided by First National Bank Alaska, offering a one-solution, tailored approach to meet the financial needs of Alaskans by providing banking services, loans, investments, and more to help shape a brighter tomorrow. Learn more at fnbalaska.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. On national forest land in Washington state, huckleberry harvesting is an early summer tradition for the Yakima Nation and other tribes in the area. Huckleberries are also a valuable commodity that outside businesses have taken advantage of in recent decades. Commercial pickers are depleting the berry supply that tribes rely on. This year, for the first time, the U.S. Forest Service is giving priority to tribal foraging for huckleberries. We'll hear from tribal members about the recent development. And in Colorado, the Ute Mountain Ute Tribe is collaborating with conservation groups to facilitate tribal access to private land for collecting food and medicine. Does your community have a traditional foraging tradition? Do you have to trespass to gather wild plants for food or ceremony? Share your knowledge and perspectives by calling 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Joining us from Goldendale, Washington is Elaine Harvey. She is the watershed manager for the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission. She is Kamilpa Band of the Yakima Nation. Elaine, good morning. Welcome to Native America Calling.
Yeah, Nick Meitzke, good morning.
Joining us from tribal headquarters in Toppenish, Washington is Bronsco Jim Jr. He is the chief of the Kamilpa Band of the Yakima Nation. Chief Jim, good morning to you as well, and welcome.
Yeah, good morning.
Joining us from Portland, Oregon is Josephine Woolington. She's a journalist. Josephine, good morning to you as well. Great to have you on the show.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
And our fourth guest joins us from Santa Fe, New Mexico, Tristan Chi. He is the Indigenous Lands Program Field Coordinator for Trees, Water, and People. He is Diné. Tristan, hello and welcome.
Hello, good morning. Thanks for having me.
I'm happy to have all of you on the show today. And Elaine, I want to begin with you. And can you start by explaining to our listeners your connection and your family's connection to berry picking?
Yeah, so we come from the Kamilpa Band, which is one of the tribes on the Mid-Columbia River. And, you know, we travel up to Mount Adams, a place called Indian Heaven. And we go up there annually, and our family's been doing this, you know, for generations of traveling up there to the mountains to gather huckleberries. And not just huckleberries, there's a variety of other berries associated in that area and medicines. And, you know, we go up there annually, camp for weeks at a time, you know, gathering food, our traditional foods. But, you know, it's, you know, just a part of our culture, our heritage. And then the huckleberries are, you know, really significant to us because, it's, you know, they're essential to our life as for subsistence purposes, but also for ceremonial purposes. And in many of the Yakima ceremonies, and I can probably say all of the Yakima ceremonies, you know, huckleberries are essential part of our table, a traditional table, as well as the different salmon, deer, the different roots and the berries.
Fascinating. And you describe this area where the huckleberry picking takes place as Indian Heaven. I love that name, yeah. Elaine. Tell me more. How did it get that name?
Well, I believe how the name came about was because it was a big gathering place for the tribes, for Yakima, the Columbia River tribes to come and gather for huckleberries. And not just huckleberries, you know, there's also deer, elk, and, you know, many other resources. But it was a summer gathering area, and, you know, it was well known for Native camping, gathering, you know, celebration, ceremonies. So, and I think, and I believe that's how the name came about on that land.
The berry supplies, how have you seen them change over the years?
The huckleberry habitat has really declined because of the lack of fire in the landscape. And so we're losing huckleberry habitat in general annually, and that's because of the fir trees are taking over. You know, historically, the tribes culturally burned the forest, you know, to keep it open and to replenish the soils. And so there has been, you know, over 100 years of no fire in the landscape. And the tribes, you know, they did it periodically, not annually, you know, depending on the huckleberry harvest. But, you know, the abundance of huckleberries has declined. And then with, you know, you put commercial harvesting on top of that, you know, it really leaves the tribes on the back burner of being able to harvest the huckleberries.
Tell us more about these commercial pickers. We mentioned them at the beginning of the show. What is the impact, and what are you seeing personally with regard to how they're impacting the berry supplies?
Yeah, so, you know, commercial picking has been occurring at the Gifford Pinchot National Forest, and I believe that's the only national forest in our area that offers commercial picking. But the numbers of commercial pickers have, you know, substantially increased over the years, and it's been happening for many years, like even post-depression time. And if you read, if you're able to read Josephine's article, she did research to show that the chiefs, our chiefs, Columbia River chiefs, documented issues with commercial harvesting, you know, nearly 100 years ago. So it's still a problem, but it's increased, you know, so significantly that it really impacts our ability to pick. And then commercial numbers are, you know, where it just became a competition for us for our first food, you know. And we have treaty reserve rights under the Yakima Nation Treaty with the U.S. government, you know, and these are reserve rights that we have on federal lands to have access to our traditional foods. And you know, I feel like our treaty rights are infringed upon when our access is limited because of the commercialization of, you know, you have commercial pickers, and then we're losing huckleberry habitat in general.
Now, you've gotten involved as an advocate, and you've been working with the Forest Service to protect access to huckleberry specifically for Native people. Elaine, tell us more about that work.
I was recently, over the past 15 months, I've been working with the U.S. Forest Service, and I was on the Northwest Forest Plan Amendment Federal Advisory Committee, and we were working on creating recommendations for tribes. And this amendment covers 17 national forests from Canada to Northern California. And we're really, you know, trying to address treaty access, tribal sovereignty issues, co-stewardship with tribes. You know, I really focus on culturally significant plants. So, you know, I'm talking about huckleberries, mushrooms, bear grass, and other basket weaving, you know, that's really important to tribes. And so we really, you know, focus on that, put recommendations in there so that the Forest Service can prioritize treaty access to our first foods, and also co-stewardship to manage the forest, and also cultural burning to allow tribes to culturally burn areas for food and weaving materials.
And what's beginning to become a partnership with the Forest Service, how's it coming along? Are you satisfied with the response so far?
I think it's a work in process. I believe it's a work in process. And it's annually, you know, there's a high turnover rate in the Forest Service. So it's an annual education we have to do. of our treaty rights, of, you know, the significance of Indian heaven and these and our foods. It's an annual, you know, education that we have to go through. But I believe it's we're slowly making progress. And I believe the Forest Service is, you know, trying to make their best effort in, you know, honoring us and our rights. But you know, there's still that commercial aspect where now you have corporations and you have other people who are looking, you know, at the huckleberries as, you know, just for the economic value. And you kind of think of other forest products. You're thinking of the like mushrooms, and you think of even the timber industry. You know, it's when industry gets involved, you know, now it's could be a whole new ballgame where we're dealing and going up against corporations.
Elaine, there was also a handshake agreement, I believe, with these commercial pickers. Can you explain more about what that was and how it's being enforced?
Okay, so the handshake agreement is an agreement between our chief at the time. His name was William Yellup, and he and other elders, you know, they approached the Forest Service and said, because this is post-Depression time. So during the Depression, there was a lot of non-natives coming up and kind of pushed the tribal people aside for huckleberries, because at the time, you know, Depression was a time of, you know, desperate needs for people. So post-Depression, our chief, William Yellup, who was a Kamitpa chief, approached the Forest Service and said, we need a reserve, we need to do something to protect an area, at least, you know, for the Mid-Columbia River tribes. And so they created this handshake agreement where it allows us to pick in a certain area. So if you go up there in Indian Heaven, you'll see signs and it says, this area is reserved for tribes on this side of the road. And so there's like 2,000 of our acres reserved for us. And the Forest Service, you know, they said it's for us, but we do see commercial pickers in our area. And this is just one designated area. And we're hoping, you know, to have other designated areas that could be for tribal members to harvest huckleberries. But yeah, so that's one area as a result of the Depression.
Elaine Harvey, kicking off our discussion today on Native America Calling. She is the watershed manager for the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission. We're going to take a short break. We're going to come back and we'll talk with Chief Bronsko Jim Jr. He's in Toppenish, Washington. Listeners, stay with us. And if you'd like to join the conversation, call us 1-800-996-2848.
Blue Adams calls herself a serial restaurateur, and her new eatery, The Continental in Provo, Utah, reimagines American cuisine through an indigenous lens. And Yurok and Karuk author Brooke Thompson celebrates dam removal and restoration in her new children's book, I Love Salmon and Lampreys. That and more is on the menu on the next Native America Calling.
My name is Tammy, and I'm a member of the Little Traverse Bay Band of Odawa Indians. Smoking gave me heart disease. I used to think of cigarette smoking as something that only affected me. Then at just 44 years old, I had to look into my mom's eyes on the way into emergency heart surgery and tell her, Mommy, I promise I won't make you bury me. My tip is, think about the people in your life who love you. They go through the pain too, maybe even more than you do.
The people you love are worth quitting for. You can quit. For free help, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. A message from the CDC.
Yo and a hey,
You've got it tuned to Native America Calling. We're talking about access to land for plant harvesting. Tribes are working to preserve and expand access for gathering food and medicine on land that was once open but is now managed privately or by government agencies. Please expand our conversation by adding your insights on traditional foraging practices. Call now, 1-800-996-2848. 1-800-996-2848. In just a moment, we're going to talk with Chief Bronsco Jim Jr. But before that, I have one more question for Elaine Harvey with the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission. And Elaine, hearing you describe this scenario there in and around Indian Heaven, as you describe it, it sounds like there are just a lot of different interests here at work. You have, of course, the native people there who are picking. You also have commercial interests. You have non-native pickers. You have park visitors. I'm curious to know, have there been any conflicts with any of these parties with regard to accessing these berries and other resources?
Yes, with some of the commercial pickers, and not all, but there's some that really stop us from picking, like they'll park on the road when there's good berries back there, or they harass us with dogs, and sometimes they harass the elder woman, and it's kind of it gets scary. And so for the tribal people, we have to be aware all the time where we're at and the people around us, because some of the commercial pickers, unfortunately, are harassing mainly the woman folk and the elders. So, yeah, it gets to be a scary situation, too.
Yeah, it sounds like. Elaine, you take care of yourself, along with everyone else who's out there picking for these berries. Yeah, I really appreciate you coming on the show. Chief Bronsco Jim Jr., he is on the line as well. He's in Toppenish, Washington. And Chief Jim, I want to ask you a similar question to what I asked Elaine earlier. Access to berry picking for the Yakima Nation in recent years, how have you seen it change throughout your lifetime?
Isn't it much different than the statements Elaine has made in the recent couple decades? The commercialization of the berries has highly impacted our people.
Okay. And your connection.
And they overpick. They pick too early. They, our people, some of our people are employees also. And when they get there on their time off or the weekend, and then the berries are already gone, and the native people had no chance to, gather any berries for their subsistence use. We're not there for to gain a dollar.
Right. Chief Jim, I love huckleberries. I think a lot of the people listening to the show right now love huckleberries. Anywhere you go in the United States, you will find huckleberry pancake syrup. You will find huckleberry pie filling. You will find so many products. And I'm curious, I would imagine these products, all these berries are sourced by commercial pickers. Any idea how many of these products, or to what extent these huckleberries that we see on sale commercially across the country and maybe across the world come from your region of the country?
Well, we imagine quite a bit, because when we meet with the U.S. Forest Service, they report on thousands, 60,000, hundreds of thousands of berries that are only reported. Imagine what's not reported. And
right.
our people choose to, our family, wants to boycott items that you see in stores, huckleberry soda, huckleberry syrup, because we know where it's coming from and how it affects our people out in the gathering grounds.
How's that going? Because I'm actually going to be near your part of the country next week, and I know a lot of the ice cream stores, they sell huckleberry milkshakes and other products. Is it making a difference, or is that a concerted effort to boycott?
I don't know if like a lot of Native people in our own community may realize that, because some of them are like, oh, look, there's Huckleberry soda, you know, because mm-hmm. it is a traditional food. And then when you don't think about it, you're enticed or intrigued, like, hey, I'm going to get that. That's cool. But, you know, when you really think about it, like in our family, like our ladies are like, don't support that, because that hurts us. It really does.
Well, tell us more about your family and their personal connection to Huckleberries.
Well, it's beyond solely our family. It's our community as Native people. It's a food that's been there well before commercialism, before the states of the United States were ever established. It preempts reservations. It's tied to our way of belief, and that's the intimate tie that we have. There's so much to it's sacred. It ties to a sacred story, to our belief, and that's what we share with our people within our ceremonies. It isn't anything that we talk about publicly, and we just would like the public to perhaps at least understand that much and respect it.
Mm-hmm. Elaine talked earlier about this burgeoning partnership with the U.S. Forest Service and attempting to halt commercial berry picking. How pleased are you with that partnership so far? And you think it's accomplishing, or at least is en route to accomplishing, what the goal is?
This past year, it feels like, you know, we finally made some impact, because it's been a fight that has been pushed for a few years to come this far. However, there's worry with the current president and administration, and impacts from what he's doing with terminating, you know, and part of it comes with the Forest Service, and we are a little afraid that it may impact us, being we deal with the United States Forest Service.
Mm. And some of the other families there in the community that are also deeply connected to the Huckleberry, sounds like everybody on some level is deeply connected to the Huckleberry. What are you hearing from those folks, and what are their concerns?
On commercial picking?
Yeah, just this conflict right now between the Native indigenous people that have been picking there for generations upon generations, and some of these commercial interests that we're talking about today, and these folks that are marketing these products and probably making a whole lot of money in the process.
Yeah, they are people that experience it firsthand, and it means a lot for it to come from the ladies that have bad experiences, such as, you know, when one of our ladies said, when there's a lot of men on a picking crew of commercial pickers, it's intimidating for a lady, and it brings in fear. And they also utilize dogs to be intimidating and to, you know, eventually try to scare off the Native pickers. Those are the things that they experience, and we tell the Forest Service, you know, it's like over and over, and it feels like now that there's been a representation that has been kind of consistent for the last 3 years now, because prior to that, I think we've gone through 3 forest district rangers. To us, they're climbing the corporate ladder. And, you know, we educate them, we talk to them, we invite them to our ceremony in the mountains, you know, specifically for berries of what we're doing, why we do this. And the next year they're gone, you know, and then someone else is there. Then we're re-educating. But this person now has been there, and it feels like, you know, we're crossing our fingers, like, hopefully she'll stay. And you know, we'll get someplace. Because in the past, there's, you know, been a district ranger who was there for a number of years, who's multi-generational friends to our families. And we're hoping for another person like that who will invest time to listen to the Native people in the community, and we can work together. But prior to that, it's been re-educating, trying to influence, trying to teach. And I don't know if I kind of went on a tangent on that.
No, that was good. That was good. Well, I'm curious also, commercial interests. The Yakama Nation, do you folks have any commercial interests with the Huckleberry as well? Are there like some locally sourced products that people can buy, perhaps there at the tribal headquarters or other areas that you folks are involved with commercially?
No. Our families are just pretty much subsistence and ceremonial usage. And I'm from the Columbia River. I commute to Toppenish to the reserve to work in the language program on a daily basis. So I don't really know everything that's going on here, or maybe there is. You know, there are businesses, gift shops and stuff that are owned by Native people.
Mm-hmm. All right. Chief Jim, thank you so much. I want to bring Josephine Woolington into our conversation now. She's in Portland, Oregon. She is a journalist. And Josephine, you've reported on this issue for High Country News. I want to ask you what you learned about how the Forest Service has been managing this land with or without tribal input, and what the impact has been on the health of huckleberry bushes and the berries themselves.
Yeah, as Elaine mentioned, you know, some of the Kamilpa chiefs and the Mid-Columbia River chiefs in the kind of post-Depression, pre-Depression era voiced a lot of these same concerns. I think it's important to keep in mind that the Treaty of 1855 came before the Forest Service even existed, and the periodic fires that Elaine mentioned and how the tribes cared for the berries, the lack of fire on the landscape since the early 1900s until today has prevented, you know, taken away, I don't have a percentage, but a vast majority of the huckleberry habitat. The Forest Service came in and, you know, these are treaty protected cultural resources, and the Forest Service turned them into commodities, special forest products, claimed these lands that were reserved for tribal use in the treaties as public. And so now, you know, anyone non-native could come up to this area in Gifford Pinchot National Forest and take huckleberries. And so that kind of attitude has led to kind of where we are today, with all these commercial products of huckleberries, with these corporations like Tillamook Creamery making huckleberry ice cream, likely from berries gathered in Gifford Pinchot. And it's the ability of the Forest Service to take that treaty protected resource and turn it into something that, you know, non-natives can make money off of, has been happening, you know, for 100 years. And the chief from Celilo, Tommy Thompson, said, you know, in 1929, the white men are commercializing our berries. And that's continuing.
Okay. Josephine, I want to pivot back to Elaine quickly here. And Elaine, you know, here again, this might not be, maybe this might be an obvious question for somebody who really knows huckleberries, but I'm, for a listener that doesn't understand the industry all that well, somebody might be thinking, well, why can't these commercial pickers just buy a big piece of land and grow their own berries? Why can't they foster their own orchards or their own bushes for huckleberries and just divert all this conflict between this Indian Heaven territory where you folks are?
Huckleberries are, you know, require certain, they require snow, they require you know, high elevation. They grow in high elevation. They require, you know, a lot of snow during the winter. And so it's kind of restricted in the areas that they can grow. And I've heard, like, other universities trying to propagate huckleberry, like, in a nursery, and those were unsuccessful. So yeah, it's really not a plant that you can grow in a nursery or, you know, in a farm setting. Yeah, okay. So
got it. Yeah, thank you for that clarification, Elaine. I want to take a caller now. This is Chanupa, listening in Pine Ridge, South Dakota on Keeley Radio. Big brother, you're on the air today. How you doing?
You know, Sean. You know, a lot of our elders take a good understanding with our sacred our land because of this thing. Our champha, which is the choke cherries, okay? And they're everywhere, but people never, ever give it to the elders first. They forget them, but I still do. I'm 67 years old, but I give it back to my elders. And one thing that we do, we make an understanding like a pudding, okay? It's berry pudding, okay? It's like a wojapi. So when you have your fry bread, you can dip it in there, okay? So that's our really understanding to our people. So my elders that are listening, Daku Lenam, Champha Hena Luhab Hanta, Dakomani Wok Shapiki Hena Yankee. So that's for the elders' understanding, because without it, then they wouldn't know. But thank you for giving me that understanding. Remember, Champha Hena Echa Wok Yiki Lena Yankee, Sean. And thank all of you for having a good day. Hokahe.
All right, Chanupa, thank you so much. And I've enjoyed more than a few bowls of wojapi in my time. So, yeah, definitely a very, very delicious, tasty dish from our relatives there in the Northern Plains area. So we're going to take another break. We're going to come back. We'll talk more with Josephine Woolington and our other guests. And we also have Tristan Chi in Santa Fe, New Mexico, who's going to join us as well. So stay tuned. And if you would like to also join the conversation, if you have any interest in huckleberries, maybe you forage for huckleberries yourself, or you're someone who just enjoys huckleberries, give us a call. You can join our conversation, 1-800-996-2848. If you don't feel like talking on the phone today, go to our website, NativeAmericaCalling.com, or check us out on social media. Go to our Facebook page, Instagram, Blue Sky, Threads. Any of those platforms will work, and you can post and comment on what you like about today's show. 1-800-996-2848 if you want to use the phones or social media and the website. We'll be right back.
Trickster Cultural Center hosts the 11th Annual National Gathering of American Indian Veterans to honor veterans and military personnel of all cultures, eras, and branches in a native way. Trickster Cultural Center's National Gathering of American Indian Veterans is open to the public at no charge Friday, July 18th and Saturday, July 19th in Schaumburg, Illinois. More at tricksterculturalcenter.org/national-gathering-2025. Trickster Cultural Center supports this show.
If you see a teen or adult suddenly collapse, it's important to act fast and start hands-only CPR. Call for emergency medical help and an AED. Push hard and fast in the center of the chest, giving 100 to 120 compressions per minute until help arrives. Learn more from the American Heart Association about the life-saving skill of CPR at heart.org/nation. The American Heart Association supports this show.
Support by the American Indian College Fund. The American Indian College Fund provides millions of dollars of scholarships to thousands of Native students every year. Tribal citizens of every age and experience are eligible. The deadline for applications is May 31st, and you can find everything you need to apply at collegefund.org. That's collegefund.org, or by phone at 800-766-FUND. Education is the answer. Support by Sanofsky Chambers Law, championing tribal sovereignty and Native American rights since 1976, from opioids litigation to treaty rights to tribal self-governance, with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska. Sanofsky Chambers Law.
Support for journalism that raises the awareness of child well-being to citizens and to policymakers provided by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, building a brighter future for children, families, and communities. Information at aecf.org.
This is Native America Calling, and there is still plenty of time if you'd like to join our conversation about land where traditional wild foods and resources grow. Give us a call at 1-800-996-2848. We have Josephine Woolington on the line. She's a journalist in Portland, Oregon. And Josephine, before break, you gave us some background on the reporting you've done for High Country News with regard to these huckleberry issues we're talking about today. Any developments since you began your reporting that you can share with us today?
Yeah, so I started reporting this story about a year ago, I might turn it over to Elaine, but the Forest Service in September, I went to a meeting, which was the Federal Advisory Committee meeting that's recommending amendments to the Northwest Forest Plan that Elaine was a member of. And at that meeting, the regional forest supervisor said that that they're going to study the commercial program in Gifford Pinchot, which is the only national forest where this large-scale commercial use of huckleberries occurs. No other national forest allows any commercial picking of huckleberries, even though it happens still, because it's very there's a lack of enforcement regarding this issue. But in September, so the regional forest supervisor said that the Gifford Pinchot would study the commercial program and decide whether or not to make any changes. And so Elaine had mentioned that they said that they were going to take a pause on the commercial program this year.
All right. Thank you, Josephine. Elaine, before I move on to our next guest, Tristan Chi, do you have anything to add with regard to some of these updates?
Yeah. So I did, from one of our previous meetings, final meetings of our Federal Advisory Committee, the forest supervisor did mention that she was taking this as a leadership commitment outside of the forest amendment, and they were going to pursue the temporary pause to do this study, and we're hoping that they do this, and that that commercialization of huckleberries will end in the Gifford Pinchot National Forest, because the huckleberries are really significant to us, and huckleberries are really part of our tribal food sovereignty, I believe. But thank you for this time.
Absolutely. I want to thank you and Chief Jim as well for joining the conversation, adding so much value and so much insight for our listeners. Let's talk now with Tristan Chi. He's in Santa Fe, New Mexico, where he is the Indigenous Lands Program Field Coordinator for Trees, Water, and People. Tristan, hello again, and thank you for joining the show. And you're involved with a program, the Traditional Harvest Project. It focuses on building access to land for foraging. Can you tell us more about the goals for this project?
Yeah, hello. So the main goals for this project, again, it's a Traditional Harvest Project, and this is a groundbreaking aspect of, tribal access to ancestral homelands that have been, owned by private landowners for a while now. But the main goals of this project is to allow tribal members of the Ute Man Ute tribe to those private lands to be able to access and harvest traditionally and cultural significant plants in the area, while also doing some conservation efforts of riparian restoration in the area as well.
Now, here we're talking about private landowners as opposed to Forest Service land. What does it take to get those kind of agreements with private landowners as opposed to public?
Yeah, so it's a really big collaboration that has been happening for a while. So far in this project, we want to mention that the Ute Man Ute tribe is forefronting this project with their resources and the sources that they can be able to
accumulate for this project as well. But it does take a good conglomeration of partners. So in this project, there are partners of Montezuma Land Conservancy, who are located in Cortez, Colorado, and Trees, Water, and People. We are located here in Santa Fe as well. It takes those partners to, you know, come together and to be able to have resources and accesses to these private landowners. The private landowners, have some sort of conservation easement or just protection of their lands, and they are connected with Montezuma Land Conservancy. And in that regard, the Ute-Man Ute tribe, is trying to gain access to lands that are off the reservation. So these private landowners are able to connect through these partnerships, through these people who have connection with the Ute-Man Ute tribe in the area, to be able to get those access available for them.
Tell me more about how it works. How do you get introduced to tribes, or how do they connect with you? And then what's the first step to get these projects started?
Yeah, so first and foremost, having the respect of tribal nations and their sovereignty. Tribal nations are sovereign nations, and they have their own ability to, move as they like in their resources and what they want to for their own tribal nations and communities. So that's kind of, the main goal, and having these tribal nations being able to come to these community members or come to the private landowners to ask them about these abilities. But also even just putting out, a resource, some sort of news that they're able to, have access to these lands. And, from that perspective, it brings a lot of internal involvement from private landowners who are willing to give access to tribal members in that perspective.
And these different tribes that you're working with, you've mentioned the Ute Mountain Ute tribe there in Toyoak, Colorado, among others. Do they have different needs and different goals when pursuing these partnerships? And if so, maybe describe or compare how some of their directives and some of their ambitions might differ.
Yeah. So, along with this project, it's with, harvesting traditionally cultural significant plants and also restoring those areas with native plants. So there is a really big degradation of invasive species in the area that are, fighting for the water, fighting for land. But those invasive species are not significant to this area or to the tribal members themselves. So replanting native plants into the area is a big goal in this aspect as well. There's also this idea that has been along with all tribal nations, which is the rematriation of the land. A lot of that rematriation is this idea of going back to the land, reconnecting with the land, and also reconnecting with historical stories between the tribal members and non-tribal members who own these private lands. And those histories have been, and for a long time have been either severed or have either been, very negative in that context. And this is a really big effort for the tribal nations and community members to relive that reconnection process for the private land or through the private landowners.
Trust in that term, rematriation with the land. I think that's going to resonate with a lot of listeners today. And I'm curious, based on so many initiatives and so much interest across Indian country with regard to rematriation with land and land buyback and taking more stewardship of these lands, are you seeing increased demand? And are you seeing more tribes and others reaching out and wanting to develop similar partnerships, wanting to have these lands protected or secured, and wanting to save these plants as well?
Yes, I can say positively there is a strong output, outcry, from tribal nations to have that idea of rematriation, and also to have access to these private lands. And it's, through this context of our tribal nations are on reservations, we have boundaries where our plants are traditionally significant plants and sacred areas are off of those reservations, right? So what this idea brings to is that we have all tribal members have ancestral homelands, and those ancestral homelands are inaccessible most of the time through private landowners or through federal lands. And this is the idea of rematriation and the bigger context of land back, and that's the same idea through conservation. It's a new way of seeing conservation through the eyes of indigenous-led projects that have this goal in it, and this goal and entitled process of rematriation of the land and being able to have not just have access, right, but also to regain the land back to where it once was, that reconnection of the land and having it to be preserved and having their kids and their generations to be able to go on that land in the future as well.
How much work do you do with the Department of Interior, and what are your concerns going forward when we're seeing some pretty significant changes there at DOI?
Yeah, so as the partners that we have here currently, Trees, Water, and People, Montezuma Land Conservancy, the Yuma-Nu Tribe, I can say right now that, you know, with the Department of Interior, a lot of the processes that we do right now is grassroots efforts. So a lot of our efforts are very grassroots in the context of, federal grant money, local fundraising, things like that. So a lot of the Department of Interior that's kind of what, our goal is to as well, is to kind of get access and start, having those conversations with DOI. And those conversations have been happening alongside with the Yuma-Nu Tribe and our partners as well. But, to kind of keep this short and sweet, is that the projects that Trees, Water, and People supports for those indigenous communities is that, we want to make sure that those indigenous communities are feeling supported by us, because it is, their main goal, and it's what they want to pursue for their community. So in that context, there is some work happening with DOI to be able to push this forward. But now with the current administration, it's kind of pushed back a little bit.
Trees, Water, and People, do you folks offer workshops or any type of training? Because I'm thinking about somebody who might be listening to the show right now, and they might not be working directly with a tribe. They might not be involved in any actual rematriation with land efforts or projects, but they might just have an interest in being more observant or being more mindful of conservation and strategies to accomplish that. Do you provide resources or any assistance for folks interested in that?
Yeah. So resources that we have, we always try to support our partners and tribal nations that we support too as well. So look, having their input is very helpful as well. But we do have a website, treeswaterandpeople.org. And a lot of what we do is we are very grassroots, but we are very a small nonprofit organization. And I don't want to say don't offer workshops, but we also offer a lot of opportunities to have volunteer programs to be able to do reforestation efforts inside of, ancestral homelands or on tribal nation lands. And those reforestation efforts are planting, native trees back into the area from forest fires and kind of things in that same perspective. But yes, we do offer some of that ability, and we do offer a lot of information based on what type of work we are doing and what type of work that we see tribal nations leading and wanting to support. And those are all through we have blogs and helpful information on our website with Trees, Water, and People, and also in support with our partnerships as well, Montezuma Land Conservancy .org as well. They do have some very helpful information there as well.
What got you into this kind of work, Tristan?
This work has really been living inside the context of who I am. Listening to all the people on the radio station today, they are indigenous, and they are from their communities, and they have been raised by indigenous families and cultures and traditions. I have been so as well, and I've been very blessed to be raised by matriarchs in my community. And that's the idea, is that, you know, when we step forward into our adulthood or our lives, our turns to protect what we want, that is, you know, the living embodiment of who has raised me. And that's, you know, the earth, the mother, Mother Earth, who takes care of us and all of us and gives us what we need. And in return, what we take is, you know, we also got to give that back as well. And that's in regards of prayers, restoration, thankfulness, and being kind to one another. And that's what really got me into this work, as a conservationist, as an artist, you know, as a friend, and as a partner. Yeah.
All right. Well, unfortunately, we are out of time, so we're going to have to wrap up this conversation now. But the conversation continues on social media and our website. So if you didn't have a chance to call in today, you can still post on our Facebook page. You can post on Instagram. You can check out NativeAmericaCalling.com. You can learn more about our guest today on our website as well. And again, the guests who joined us are Josephine Woolington, Elaine Harvey, Chief Bronsco Jim Jr., and Treston Chi. Join us again on Monday. We'll start the week with a discussion about a new indigenous restaurant in Utah and a children's book looking at dam removal. Our executive producer is Art Hughes. Our producers are Andy Murphy and Sol Traverso. Joe Thompson is the UNM Local News Fellow. Marino Spencer is the engineer. Show McPolin is the digital producer. Nola Daves Moses is the distribution director. Bob Peterson is the network manager for Native Voice One. Clifton Chadwick is our national underwriting sales director. Antonia Gonzalez is the anchor for National Native News. Charles Sather is our chief operations officer. The president and CEO of Kwanic Broadcast Corporation is Jacqueline Salee. I'm Sean Spruce. You've been listening to the one, the only Native America Calling. We'll talk again soon.
Support provided by Amerind. Amerind is 100% tribally owned and partners with tribes and their businesses to provide affordable commercial insurance coverage, protect tribal sovereignty, and strengthen Native American communities by helping to keep dollars in Indian country. Information about property, liability, commercial auto, and workers' comp available at Amerind.com. That's Amerind.com.
Program support by AmeriCorps Vista, where you can kickstart your career and help others in your community. With AmeriCorps Vista, you can serve in an office setting and address issues of poverty while gaining career experience and building your leadership skills. Learn more by visiting AmeriCorps.gov/Vista today. That's AmeriCorps.gov/Vista.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service.
I wrote Chew Tobacco Rag for you, and here's old Chew Tobacco Rag number two. Chew Tobacco, Chew Tobacco Rag number two. Now the spitting on this song's brand spanking new, I'm gonna spit it all together different for you. Chew-tobacco, rag number two. Chew-tobacco, spit, spit, spit. Let's all take a chew and have a spittin' fit. Chew-tobacco, rag number two. Man, I've got a gal.